Welcome to this RCGP podcast, where we'll be exploring autoimmune hepatobiliary disease, including the importance of these conditions in the context of the current coronavirus pandemic. I'm joined today by Dr. Kevin Barrett, who's a GP in Hertfordshire and chair of the Primary Care Society of Gastroenterology. Thanks for talking to us, Kevin.
Thank you, Emma.
Most GPs will be familiar with the terms autoimmune hepatitis and primary biliary cholangitis, or PBC, which are the two conditions that we're really looking at today. But probably most people don't have that many patients with these conditions. How common are they?
So yeah, these are interesting conditions. There's quite a lot of overlap between the two of them, between autoimmune hepatitis and primary biliary cholangitis. They're both rare diseases though, with similar-ish prevalence around 1 in 3,000 to 4,000. Around about 80% of cases of autoimmune hepatitis and 90% of cases of primary biliary cholangitis occur in women. Primary biliary cholangitis affects around 1 in 800 women over the age of 45, so a slightly older population. The median age of diagnosis is around 65, so again fits with that sort of a typical older age group. The annual incidence of both is quite low, so it's around 2 to 3 per 100,000, so it means that once patients are diagnosed, they tend to have it quite a long time. With that incidence, though, means that we don't really see that many new cases in primary care, but I guess a typical practice of 10,000 patients, you know, we'll have a handful of patients with them.
Okay, so my understanding is that there's a variety of components to the etiology of autoimmune hepatitis, or commonly referred to as AIH. In the first instance, given that you've said about how rare it is, when might we consider it as a possible differential?
Autoimmune conditions, there's often with these things, whether it's autoimmune hepatitis or inflammatory bowel disease or rheumatoid arthritis, there seems to be a combination of environmental trigger that sets off something to do with people who have genetic susceptibility. And with lots of these conditions, no one really understands what that is or what the interaction between the two are. There's lots of research going on into these things and a whole range of different theories about it, and lots of research into the genetics. As with any autoimmune condition, autoimmune hepatitis and primary biliary cholangitis, they're both more common in patients with pre-existing autoimmune conditions. So again, as before, rheumatoid arthritis, celiac disease, autoimmune thyroiditis, or ulcerative colitis, that they're all conditions that make one more likely to get primary biliary cholangitis or autoimmune hepatitis. Therefore, a family history, that's always a red flag. So if someone comes to you and says, you know, I've got a family history of autoimmune liver disease or PBC, then that should certainly set your alarm bells ringing. They have identified a single gene mutation that certainly accounts for a proportion of cases. And in those situations, the relative risk can be as high as 35 times the normal risk for daughters of women with primary biliary cirrhosis. Again, that female preponderance certainly, you know, does point towards a genetic factor in the majority of cases. Primary biliary cirrhosis. Now, that's the old name for it. It's now known as primary biliary cholangitis. Usually develops quite gradually, so which can make it quite harder and much harder to detect sometimes than autoimmune hepatitis. Autoimmune hepatitis certainly can come on quite dramatically and trigger acute liver failure, which obviously is, you know, is fairly obvious with people presenting with jaundice and the typical signs of that. Whereas primary biliary cholangitis, the most common initial symptom is just fatigue, which makes it really tricky because we can't assume that every patient who comes to us complaining they're tired has autoimmune hepatitis. Pruritus is definitely a symptom we should think about. Again, about 20% of patients with it actually have that horrible itchiness, that persistent itchiness that doesn't go away. And that's probably for me the symptom that should warrant further investigation in primary care. Particularly women with another autoimmune condition, those are those red flags that set it off. Both conditions, again, lead to jaundice because of the cirrhosis aspect of it as well. And just think about remote consulting these days with COVID-19 and all the video consulting and telephone consulting we're doing as well. So it's always important to make sure that when you're seeing a patient face to face, that they're in good light, they're under good light, they've got a decent quality camera, and just have a, you know, ask for a close up, just to have a look at their eyes to see if they are jaundiced. Again, harder in some groups of patients than others. And I think if there's any doubt about that, then a very brief COVID-safe face-to-face appointment is worth doing as well. And obviously, if you can see a patient face-to-face, you can have a look for other signs as well. So ascites, splenomegaly, palpate the abdomen, and even look for xanthelasma around the eyes, because having raised cholesterol can be a sign of altered liver function. With other conditions as well, just think about it when patients present with unexplained fractures, because when you get primary biliary cholangitis, you get the reduction in absorption of fat-soluble vitamins. So vitamin D is one of those key ones, A, D, E, and K are the fat-soluble vitamins that we all know about. And again, just watch out for that hypercholesterolemia. So if you see a sudden increase in someone's cholesterol levels, just bear that in the back of your mind, although probably by the time that happens, you'll see an abnormal liver function test and other things will be clear as well. We also talked about risk factors. So smoking, as with almost every disease, is a risk factor. Again, there is some studies that show that patients that are more likely to get primary biliary cholangitis if they've had cholestasis in pregnancy. And there's also another link with patients with recurrent urinary tract infections. Again, that's a correlation rather than there's no causative factor that's been identified in those groups. And I guess the other thing to think about as well is those patients that where we investigate and do liver function tests as a standard part of our normal practice, and we just see a persistently raised alkaline phosphatase, particularly when the gamma GT is also raised. So again, it's just one of those conditions you think, actually, why is this person's liver function test? Why are they going off? What's deteriorating? Is there a cause for it? I've not changed medication. I've not done anything else. Just think, actually, is there an autoimmune condition going on? It's rare, but it's definitely worth thinking about.
Okay, so there's obviously lots of different things that could potentially point you to a diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis. So if it comes across your radar, what would you say is the best practice in testing for autoimmune hepatitis? And would you say there's any pitfalls that GPs need to be aware of?
It's one of those histological diagnoses, which is clearly not something we would do in primary care. So the tests that we can do in primary care, we can look for anti-mitochondrial antibodies, so AMA, and they're positive in 95% of the cases of primary biliary cirrhosis. But obviously, with all autoimmune conditions, you get some patients who are antibody negative. So AMA antibodies are definitely worth doing. And if they're positive in a patient with those classic symptoms or deranged liver function tests, it's worth seeking some advice from a hepatologist or a gastroenterologist with interest in liver disease, depending on what's available locally. They do, the guidance from the British Society of Gastroenterology says actually sometimes you don't need to do a liver biopsy in all cases. If you've got a very clear diagnosis and an abnormal ultrasound scan and the bloods are abnormal, then you don't necessarily need to do that. But in the majority of cases, particularly where the diagnosis is a bit unsure, then they would want to do that one. The other thing to think about actually is we talked a lot about it being more prevalent in women. Obviously, 10% of cases do occur in men. And because we don't really think of it as often in men, they tend to be diagnosed late. And also demographics as well that play a part. So, patients from more deprived areas with sort of non-Caucasian demographics, deprivation, all those sorts of things, they can have an effect as well. So those groups of patients tend to be diagnosed late. I know it was International Men's Day recently, so we need to think about men in this particular situation and just be a little bit more wary about those men with abnormal liver function tests and not just put it all down to, hypercholesterolemia and alcohol and all those sorts of things that typically affect men.
So obviously autoimmune hepatitis isn't something that we would routinely manage in primary care. So when we're referring somebody on for suspected autoimmune hepatitis, what should we tell the patient about what might happen when they see the consultant?
Yeah, it's one of those conditions, again, it's quite rare. So not many GPs are particularly familiar with it, and I've not seen many patients through that journey. If patients go and have a search on the internet for things, they come up with all sorts of horror stories, because the internet tends to tell you the worst case situation for everything as well. You have to say, actually, that there are some more investigations that need to be done. So liver ultrasound is probably the main one that almost every patient will get. And then liver biopsy, which, for those of us that remember seeing those, during our house jobs and medical school days, they're not fun things to have done. And you need to warn patients about the discomfort and bleeding and consequences of a liver biopsy as well. I think the key thing to say to patients, as with all autoimmune conditions, is that it can be progressive. Although patients generally, when they're diagnosed older, they tend to have a less severe or less worse prognosis. If you're diagnosed when you're young and you're a man, the prognosis on the whole tends to be worse than for women diagnosed later in life as well. Treatment options, again, autoimmune hepatitis, I think the main ones they use are immunosuppressants, so corticosteroids, again, just the risk of the increased risk of COVID-19 or susceptibility to COVID-19 is an issue with that as well, particularly in this day and age. And then azathioprine is the main one, which, you know, we're familiar with using and prescribing for our patients with Crohn's disease particularly. And then primary biliary cirrhosis, or primary biliary cholangitis, I keep calling it by the old name. There are two main therapies for that. You've got ursodeoxycholic acid, UDCA is the main one. And then you've got obeticholic acid, OCA, for those who don't tolerate the former. These are obviously things that will be initiated by secondary care. And most patients actually, you know, will be under the care of secondary care. So we don't need to worry too much about some of the more exotic treatments that they might use. The problem with these conditions, they're progressive, and if they're untreated and patients are unlucky, they can lead to cirrhosis, and those ones may end up needing a liver transplant. So again, patients with this generally should still be under secondary care follow-up and have regular reviews and regular contact with their secondary care team, just to assess their disease progress and response to treatment.
Now, you mentioned the terminology primary biliary cirrhosis has now been changed and is referred to now as primary biliary cholangitis. What's the difference and why did the terminology change?
I think it was first recognised, PBC, primary biliary cirrhosis, as it was first called, was first recognised in 1851. Had a look through the history books back then as well. So it's been recognised for a long, long time. And it's actually been recognised, you know, for longer than other conditions. So I know inflammatory bowel disease particularly was only sort of recognised sort of the turn of the century, but in the beginning of the last 100 years or so. 2014 was a turning point in the terminology. It was recognised that actually that primary biliary cirrhosis is a disease that kind of had sort of connotations that patients weren't happy with. So there's lots of stigma around it because cirrhosis, you know, is associated with alcoholism and, you know, it's sort of a self-inflicted type disease. I know that alcoholism isn't necessarily self-inflicted, but, you know, society still has these perceptions of that. And also the cirrhosis bit actually doesn't always happen till the late stages. So you can get the cholangitis where you get the destruction of the biliary tree, and that can happen quite early on, but then the cirrhosis happens later on. So the patient groups said, actually, we don't want it to be called cirrhosis any longer. Can we change it to be called primary biliary cholangitis?
Now, there's no getting away from the fact that COVID is impacting everything that we're doing at the moment. And so in the setting of the COVID pandemic, patients and staff are often concerned about the risk from the virus. The evidence is that we're fairly confident that having an autoimmune disease per se does not massively increase the risk of catching the condition. But there are issues about the illness severity should someone with these conditions be infected with coronavirus. Do these concerns relate to the condition itself or the treatment?
When shielding was first announced back in March and April of 2020, every patient with autoimmune hepatitis who were taking immunosuppressive treatments were advised to shield. And those with decompensated cirrhosis were advised to adhere to strict social distancing, which is kind of seems a little bit, you know, now we know a lot more about it. Things are a little bit different. And there are some differences throughout the four nations in the UK, so it's worth having a look at the most recent guidance for whichever country you're in as well. The current guidance is that the patients with chronic liver disease of any form who are taking immunosuppressants, and that includes prednisolone, a normal dose that they're taking as being immunosuppressive is 20 milligrams per day or more, although it depends what other treatments the patient's on. So that 20 milligrams per day of prednisolone is the bit that tends to have the effect on your immune system. So those groups should be considered to be clinically extremely vulnerable. I think they're trying to get away from using the word shielding these days. But obviously this decision should be made with clinical judgment, depending what else is going on in the patient's life. Again, patients with one autoimmune condition often have other things going on as well. So it seems that it's the combination of disease severity plus the immunosuppressants themselves that need to be taken into that consideration. So it's not an easy answer, but yeah, they should definitely take extra care.
Okay, and so obviously staying with the pandemic setting that we're in at the moment, we're conducting as much work remotely as can be done safely. If you were performing a review of one of these patients, what approach would you take?
Hopefully, all these patients with autoimmune hepatitis or primary biliary cholangitis should be under secondary care and have their care coordinated by that team. So our role is to make sure the patients are engaged, they are having that follow-up, they are having their bloods done, and you know, some of them will need regular liver ultrasounds, for example. So we just need to encourage them to go along and encourage the importance of them adhering to that as well, and making sure patients don't get lost to follow-up. So if they move surgeries, or they get discharged from secondary care because of COVID pressures, or they're scared of going to the hospital because of the COVID restrictions at the moment, we need to try and encourage them to carry on. Adherence to medication is important, and obviously trying to lead a healthy lifestyle. So exercise, fresh air, good diet, all the things that we should all be doing is particularly important for this group too. And again, just think about the impact on their mental health. So make sure that they have access to well-being, wellness, and you know, all the local support things too. And there are some good online support groups that patients can plug themselves into.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. I mean, we've covered an awful lot here, and it's a subject that GPs generally don't have a lot of experience in. So thank you for that. What would you say are the key take-home messages?
So the key points for me, just to make sure that we consider autoimmune hepatitis and primary biliary cholangitis at an early stage of the disease process, particularly in patients with persistently deranged liver function tests or pruritus. It's more common in middle-aged and older women, but we mustn't think it can't occur in men or younger patients, and particularly non-Caucasian men and patients from deprived backgrounds are much more likely to have a delayed diagnosis. So it's just something to think about, to bear in the back of our minds. It's uncommon, but it's important to pick it up as early as we can do.
Great. Thanks, Kevin. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing all of that knowledge with us. I certainly know that I've learned a lot from here, and that plenty of other GPs will do too. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Emma.